Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'd like to present you the electric chiral junction of light Higgs as an effective field theory approach to the standard model Higgs sector. And this work was done at the Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich in the group of Gerhard Buchala in collaboration with Oscar Carter, Alejandro Zelis, and myself. Let me start with the motivation. I think you're all familiar with the results from the LHCs. The standard model is confirmed to quite a good accuracy. Everything that we observed so far is in good agreement. There is a scalar particle that was found, was reported by ATLAS and CMS. We see in this bump over here. And the scalar particle is in agreement with what we expect from a standard model Higgs. But the experimental precision is still that we have like 10% deviations that are possible. So the big question that people are asked nowadays, what is it exactly that we observe? Is it the standard model Higgs boson? Is it a Higgs of some theory that is not standard model but slightly different? Or is it something completely else that is not related to electric symmetry breaking? And
is there a sort of phase transition where you say, oh, this is a standard model Higgs? Yeah, I can say, well, the properties of the Z boson are checked one part in 1,000. Maybe I went much better, right? But how do I know this electric, you know, gauge boson?
I think this is everybody's choice to say whether it is now called standard model or not. But
I mean, there is no strict definition, right? I mean, so anything can be given, but photon, as we know, can have a mass, right? Within bounds, right? And so it seems like a semantics, no?
Yeah. I mean, the when the Nobel laureates were announced, they were actually saying it's a standard model Higgs, so they already put that on the particle to be standard model. Like, we would say it's not yet confirmed because there's 10%, but
that's pretty damn close.
That's that's right, yeah. Yeah, no, what we like to actually do is we like to answer this question and see whether it is more like standard model or more like that there might be something else hiding between it. And the way to do this, people use effective field theories. You can use them in different ways. You can either work from so-called top-down approach, where you start with a model in your mind or a certain class of models. You look at the low energy description of it, like what are the imprints of the model, what are the predictions. And then you have an effective description of this model at your scale of your energies, or you can directly work within the model, it's also possible. But what we'd like to do is we'd like to work with effective field theories in a bottom-up approach, meaning we write down the basis of operators that fulfill certain criteria. And with that, we want to describe any model that you can assume at the UV without specifying it. So if you have a certain model in your mind, you can integrate out the heavy degrees of freedom, and you will induce a pattern of this basis operators. And this, in that sense, is model independent because you can describe many different models and you're not restricted to certain classes of the models. And when you write down this basis of operators, you need certain kinds of ingredients. You need to know or you need to specify what kind of particles you want to describe. So you need all degrees of freedom that you have at that low energy. You also need to know the symmetries and the pattern of symmetry breaking that you have at this low energy, because this is what you observe and what you want to describe. And what you also need is a consistent power counting, because this is what tells you which of the operators that you can write down are actually more important than others, and if there's a hierarchy between those operators. And with all those ingredients, you can build up the operator basis, and you can describe the theory in a model-independent way. And this brings me to the outline of my talk. In the first part, I'd like to discuss how we actually built the effective theory. So what are the ingredients that we used? What is the power counting that we had? And the second part, I will compare this description of the chiral Lagrangian to the more commonly used linear EFT. And in the third part, will be a report from our recent work where we applied this framework and actually looked at the data to see if there's something that we can learn from that. Okay, let's start. We want to build the EFT. Like I already said, we need the ingredients of the EFT as particle symmetries and power counting. So the first pretty obvious, the particles are the particles of the standard model because this is what we observed so far. We also put in the three Goldstone bosons of electric symmetry breaking because we want the W and the Z to be massive. As symmetries, you have the gauge symmetries of the standard model. With the breaking pattern of the standard model, we assume conservation of baryon and lepton number. And something that we put in as additional assumption, but we can also relax at some point, is we assume that at leading order, CP and custodial symmetry is preserved in this new Higgs sector. And for power counting, there are now two choices that you can make, and this depends on the way the symmetry is realized. If you realize the electric symmetry in a linear way, then the scalar particle, the Higgs, I call it Higgs, even though it's not sure that's 100% standard model-like, the Higgs and the Goldstones form the doublet phi. So then you have a leading order Lagrangian that is renormalizable, and you construct the next leading order terms of canonical dimension, so for example, the dimension 6 terms. This is the approach that I will discuss in the second part of my talk. It's just, I want to mention here that if you assume that the scalar and the Goldstones form a doublet, then you're putting some kind of restriction in the theory because there is some correlation between the Higgs coupling and the couplings of the Goldstones. And if you just want to explore what the nature of this new particle is, you don't necessarily have to make this restriction.
So you're not keeping a C2. This preserves a C2, right? This is what you're saying? You're going to preserve a C2 for the Higgs?
But C2 will also be preserved in a non-linear way. It's just a different way of realizing the symmetry. And in the nonlinear case, you will still keep the Goldstones that are invariant under the symmetry, but you put the Higgs as a singlet under this group, and then you will have more freedom of the couplings, and this is what tests more general what the nature of this particle is.
So if I go to the more second way of doing this, I can still probably formulate everything in terms of phi, but my operators would include probably some Schrödinger's.
Maybe constraints between the coefficients?
If you start from this and you put a special way of your couplings, then you can, of course, recover this.
Oh, okay. So
and you can also...
No, well, I'm saying that probably you can write everything in terms of phi on the right.
If you go to any order in your EFT, you can describe anything that you want. If you just go leading order and the next to leading order terms, you will see in the second part of the talk that you actually can describe different things with those two approaches. But this will be more clear in the second part. I have a nice picture where you see the different expansions, how they're organized. And okay, so the next to leading order is then not given by dimensional counting. This is what I'm gonna be discussing in the next slides. But the bottom line is that since there is no connection between the Goldstones and the scalar, it will be a more general way of describing physics. Okay, now some comments on the nonlinear realization of the symmetry. And this goes back to Kallang, Kolman, West, and Sumino. They discussed this symmetry groups in the nonlinear realization. And what they found out is that you can write down the Goldstones. So some of the Goldstones are written as phi here, as an exponential of Goldstones and the generator of the broken group. And this is the most general nonlinear way you can write down the Goldstone interactions. The kinetic term is then given as the trace of the two derivative term of those two matrices. And since this is an exponential, you can also expand the exponential. You will see that you not only get the kinetic term, but also get interactions between the Goldstones. And in this way, at leading order, this Lagrangian has one free parameter, but it describes not only kinetic term, but also all kinds of interactions leading order with just one free parameter, which is this scale that I called V here. This whole construction was used in chiral perturbation theory, where you can, I've written it down here for SU2, but you can also work it with SU3 chiral perturbation theory. Then the Goldstones are either the pions in the case of SU2 or pions and kaons in the case of SU3. And the big advantage is, even though the symmetry is non-linearly realized on the Goldstones, it will be linear realized with this U matrix. So it is very easy to build invariant operators when you write it in terms of U. Okay. Now, with this in mind, we can now go to the electroweak sector of the standard model, and we try to use the same description that we had for pion physics and chiral perturbation theory. So we assume that the Goldstone bosons and the Higgs are somehow generated by a new strong interaction. The motivation is composite Higgs models, so there will be, Higgs will be of pseudo-Goldstone nature, which makes it naturally light. But after we constructed the Lagrangian, we can also go to certain combinations of Wilson coefficients that describe theories that are not necessarily pseudo-Goldstone Higgs, but also other Higgs scenarios. So this theory had this. There's a new kind of symmetry group that you can assume. There's, for example, a model that assumes a global SO5 symmetry broken down to SO4, and then it will be the four Goldstones of that. We won't specify it here, but this is somehow the case where the effective theory will have the best application. But like I said, you can describe any other theory as well with certain combinations of coefficients. So this new strong sector, it's happening at the scale F. So if it's indeed, if you compare it to chiral perturbation theory, this will be the pion decay constant. And we further assume that the other particles of the standard model, so the transverse gauge bosons and the fermions, are weakly coupled, meaning that they not have this. So when they couple to this new strong sector, they will always couple with kind of Yukawa interactions or gauge interactions and so on. And also the pattern of symmetry breaking from the global symmetry structure we put in as SU2 left, because SU2 right broken down to the Victoria subgroup. With this construction, we can write down the Lagrangian in a similar way than for chiral perturbation theory. So the three Goldstones of electric symmetry breaking are written in terms of this U matrix. And you see now when you write down the kinetic term of them and you go to unitary gauge, you will recover the mass terms of the W and the Z. And the invariance under SU2 left and SU2 right, which is then also the gauge invariance, comes with the construction of the U matrix in this case. So you're still invariant under those symmetries. And starting from this point, we now include the Higgs as a scalar singlet as well. If we assume that the Higgs has the same Goldstone-like nature, then we also treat it in the same way, because this exponential U is not stopping at canonical dimension 4. It goes on up to infinity. So we also assume that the Higgs interactions go up to Higgs legs to the power of infinity. So it will be arbitrary polynomial that we not specify further. And since it's a gauge singlet, then there's no restriction on the coupling space symmetry either. So the leading order Lagrangian that we defined looks like this. So we have the kinetic term of the scalar, and we include an arbitrary polynomial as a potential for this Higgs. The way we've written it here is already having some field redefinitions done, because you could also multiply the kinetic term with a function of the generic scalar, but then you can do field redefinition in order to get rid of that without loss of generality. And the same is true in the potential. We already eliminated the tadpole term, but this is also just field redefinition. Then we have the kinetic term of the Goldstone that will give rise to the masses, like explained. And we also multiply this by an arbitrary polynomial of the Higgs field. Then we include the kinetic terms of all the fermions of the standard model. There you could also write down Higgs interactions that can be reabsorbed in field redefinitions. Then we include the Yukawa term. Here you also have the arbitrary Higgs interactions. The Yukawa matrices are not necessarily flavor diagonal, but you can impose flavor symmetries by phenomenological arguments and so on. So this would be some kind of restrictions that you put, but they are not necessary. And at the end, we also include the field strengths, the kinetic terms for the gauge fields. Here, we also don't put the interactions with the Higgs for two reasons. The first one is phenomenological. If we put the Higgs interaction here, this would mean a rate of Higgs production in gluon fusion, which is two orders of magnitude above what was currently observed. So it will be not compared with experiments. So we put this effect to be of next to leading order. And also this is because of the assumption that we had here that the gauge bosons are weakly coupled to this new sector, which induces this effect as next to leading order. But this will be clear in the next slide.
J is a power,
yes. I'm summing over J. I just put this general function here that I was putting over there. I can also just make the polynomial function of the Yukawa matrices at every order.
And so the fact that you did not have just a mass term for the fermions, normally the rule would be you have to write down everything that's allowed by the unbroken symmetries, right? And in your case, those are not chiral, it looks like. The rest of two is vector-like, and you've got E1 electromagnetism, and you've got color. So you would have been allowed to write non-Higgs fermion bilinears. And those are just being that you just assume that those are not there?
Yes. So we assume that this...
At this point, you're making choices. It's no longer a symmetry argument. You're making choices as to what the ultraviolet physics looks like.
Yeah, so we kind of want to describe the standard model, so we put some phenomenological information from standard model already in there. Yeah. Okay, so with this Lagrangian, we know this is not renormalizable in general. He will have arbitrarily high interactions in Higgs and in the Goldstones. So with this non-renormalizability, you can actually construct the power counting, because this, you can understand this Lagrangian actually being renormalizable in a modern way, meaning order by order in the effective expansion. So if you start from the leading order Lagrangian and you construct a one-loop diagram that is divergent and needs a counter term which is not included at leading order, then you say that this counter term has to be there and next to leading order. So at every order in your expansion, you will be renormalizable and you will have a finite amount of counter terms. Therefore, it is somehow renormalizable, but if you go to next to the next higher order, we will need new counter terms and new terms and so on. And with this argument, we actually took and then we turned the argument around, saying that, well, if these counter terms are included in next to leading order, then we could say that the basis of operators of next to leading order is given at least by the counter terms that I need for the one-loop divergencies. In this way, they're sensitive to the UV physics. And when you do this identification, you identify the expansion parameter of the EFT, so this F scaled squared over this cutoff scale lambda squared, to be of the order of a loop factor. If you make this assumption, then the next to leading order operators are somehow natural counter terms that come for your theory. So now that I have introduced the scale of expansion for the EFT, it makes sense to the, so this, we have three scales of expansion, three scales in total, so we have two ratios where we can expand. We first of all have F squared over lambda squared, but we also have the ratio of the electroweak graph V over this F squared. And because this double expansion is a bit more complicated, I will talk about it in a couple of minutes, and we will focus on the case where F is at the weak scale and we just have the expansion in terms of the loops. So this assumption that I make here will be relaxed in a couple of slides, but for now we just assume that this is the case. Basically, this reflects the construction of Technicolor-like theories where you have this scale at the weak scale and you assume that the rest of these are coming close.
So F is the analog of F pi, right?
F is the analog of F pi, yeah. V is the electroweak F.
But in QCD, what
would be the, well, in QCD, you don't have this mixture of these two sectors somehow.
You could put in a non-Goldstone scalar or something, like Meson, some up there, right? Symmetry.
Well, in this construction, yes. In Technicolor, you assume both are equal, and then V is the analog of F pi, of course. But if you have some, if there's what we observe right now, not the case of Technicolor, then you have to assume that this F pi scale is not at the scale V, but somewhere higher up. And this will be then the case where Xi is smaller than 1, I discuss later.
That's because you've got the singlet scalar that you've got the freedom to have B be a different parameter, right?
Yeah.
So the rules are you made some choices and now you're going to generate, you know, you're going to see what loops do to ruin those choices. And that's going to give you a hierarchy in the size of the coefficients of various. Because you're going to, all the things that we were asking about why you didn't have them in the previous slide, now you're going to get into some other loops.
Yeah.
And you're taking the answer that you get, the couplings that go with that loop as telling you how big the coefficients are. But if you had asked at the very beginning, is there a symmetry that is preserved? Is there a symmetry argument that would have led you to the class of operators that you wrote down? Can it be phrased that way?
I think in some cases, yes. Like, for example, this row parameter or T operator that violates custodial symmetry. We could also have written down a leading order, but we assumed that custodial symmetry is preserved a leading order, so we didn't put this custodial violating operator there. But I don't know if this is true for all the operators that you could write down in principle. Might be, but I don't want to commit to 100% of all the operators. But in some cases, definitely yes. Okay, then with this Lagrangian in mind, you can construct all the one loop diagrams. And I've written down one example here where we have two vertices coming from the Yukawa interaction, and we have a Goldstone loop, and we have one vertex coming from the Goldstone kinetic term. And if we just look at the momentum scaling of this operator, we will have P squared coming from the Goldstone vertex, we will have a P to the 4 coming from the loop integral, and we have a 1 over P squared from the three Goldstone propagators. So we would superficially assume that this diagram is log divergent. So what we include in our next leading order operator basis is a full fermion operator with two Higgs legs. And this argument you can do for all kinds of one loop diagrams. And the way we did it, we just wrote down a general scaling for a Feynman diagram with n external fields and v external vertices and all of kind of things. And then we're using topological identities of Feynman diagrams to connect the number of internal lines to the number of vertices and external lines and so on. And what you find from this construction is this power counting formula. So in general, Feynman diagram scales as p to a certain power, that I will comment on in a second. Then we have number of external Goldstones, external Higgs legs, external fermions, and external gauge fields that we have already written down in terms of field strength tensors. And the most important thing about this formula is the power of momentum, because this tells us two things. The first thing is, if this is zero or larger than zero, then we would have a superficial degree of divergence. So this would mean that we actually have to include the counter term. And the second thing is, if you work in dimensional regularization, this power of P tells us how many energy scales we would have in the final operator, so how many derivatives we have to put in this operator. So from that formula, we can actually derive all the classes of counterterms that we need. So we assume that this number is larger or equal to zero, and then we see what kind of combinations of number of external gauge fields, number of external fermions, and number of weak couplings. This is what the NV stands for. We need to have, and then we construct all those classes. This formula looks a bit long, and the construction is a bit complicated, but we were able to reformulate this formula in a way of what we called chiral dimensions. And this counting is...
Before you go, the graph you showed us had a Goldstone boson going around the loop.
Yeah.
Is that formula on the top there specific? In particular, the powers of P, is it specific to having Goldstone bosons in the loop?
Or no, any particle in the loop. Anything, yeah. And so we were able to express this formula in terms of chiral dimensions, meaning that 2L plus 2, which L being the loop order, so the quantity on the left tells us at which order in the EFT we are. If we are at leading order, this is 2. If we are next to leading order, this is 4. This number is given by the sum of the chiral dimensions of all the ingredients that we have in the operator. So the chiral dimension of the couplings, the derivatives, and the fields. And the rules that are assigned to it are very easy. The bosons have chiral dimension 0. And fermion bilinears, derivatives, and weak couplings have chiral dimension 1. And to illustrate this, I've written down an example here. So this is related to the S parameter, where we have B mu nu, W mu nu, that is just written down in a way that is invariant under the symmetries. And there is a function of the Higgs field attached to it. And since we assume that the gauge fields are weakly coupled to this new sector, we have to have a gauge coupling for every gauge field here. And if we look at this operator and we count the chiral dimensions, we find that there is one derivative in the W mu nu, there is one derivative in the B mu nu, and there are two weak couplings. So the total chiral dimension of this operator is 4. And according to our formula, we found out that this means that this operator arises at a one loop level. So we have to include this operator as next to leading order term. You also see that the formula that we have written down generalizes what was known from chiral perturbation theory, because this is essentially chiral perturbation theory with external gauging and external fermions. So if you neglect the gauge fields and external fermions and you just have a theory of the Goldstones, you find that 2L plus 2, so the loop order at the order in expansion layer, is just given by the number of derivatives, which is true for chiral perturbation theory. So the leading order terms are p squared, the next to leading order terms are p to the fourth. And this is exactly captured in this formula. It just shows that chiral perturbation theory, even though it's an expansion in derivative, doesn't mean that if you extend chiral perturbation theory by a gauge sector, that this will also be an expansion derivative. It means it's an expansion, but you also have to assign the counting of derivatives to the recouplings and to the external fermions. And then you can make this whole thing consistent.
And any part of H is equally, it's a score for that f of H could be anything. And
exactly. Yeah.
And so when you're Lagrangian, the powers of H come with something in the denominator. Is that V or is that lambda?
This is V.
V.
So now that we have a counting for general operators in an EFT that mixes strongly and weakly coupled sectors, you can also compare this counting to other countings that exist in literature. And one that is used when you have strongly and weakly coupled EFTs mixed is NDA, naive dimensional analysis, proposed by George and Manohar. And the rules that they give are the following. You have an overall factor of F squared lambda squared in front of your operator. And for every strongly interacting field, you put an F. And for every weakly interacting field, you put a lambda in the denominator. And this will give you the right scaling of operators. Well, when we compare this to our formula, what we find out is that indeed we can reproduce this counting, but only under the assumption that there are no internal gauge lines, so they have no gauge particles in the loop, and also no Yukawa interactions. If you include all of them, then you will find that NDA is giving some wrong scaling. And you can see this already by looking at the kinetic term of the gauge field, for example, if you apply those rules. So you start with F squared lambda squared, the gauge fields are not strongly interacting, so you have to put the lambda to the fourth in the denominator. So we will find that the kinetic term, which should be a leading effect, comes by a suppression of F squared over lambda squared in the counting of NDA. And this is, of course, cured in our counting, where you see this only comes with two derivatives, so it will be a leading order effect. Okay, what do we do now that we have the chiral dimensions? Well, first option, of course, the reason why we constructed them is we can classify all the next to leading order operators. So by writing down all operators that have chiral dimension 4. The next thing is something that is very nice in this construction. We have a control of the explicit breaking of symmetries, like, for example, custodial symmetry and CP. Because if we assume that the strong sector is respecting those symmetries, then every time the symmetry, you have a spurion in your operator that is breaking the symmetry, then this must come from a weak perturbation. And because weak couplings come with a chiral dimension, you can then say that every time you have the spurion, this will come with a chiral dimension. So operators that are violating custodial symmetry or CP will then be further suppressed to next to leading order and so on, under the assumption that the strong sector is actually preserving those symmetries. But this will help to further reduce the number of operators very easily. And the third option that you can do with chiral dimensions is you can gain additional information about some dimension 6 operators. For example, this one here, the trace of W mu nu to the power 3, with the assumption that it's weakly coupled to this new sector, will have a total chiral dimension of 6. So this will be an operator that arises at two loops. This was discussed before in the context of weakly coupled UV theories, but in our case, it is extended to also strongly coupled UV theories with the assumption that they are weakly coupled to the standard model particles.
So, suppose I have some theory where I put like vector one fermion, which is K, but it's charged under the SP2. Would I generate this at one loop?
It will be at one loop, but it will come with the scale lambda. And the scale lambda is 4 pi f.
Yes.
So compared to this f scale, it would have 16 pi squared squared. So in that sense, it would be a two-loop effect.
Oh, because it comes from scale lambda.
Yeah. If you assume that there are some states at f,
yes,
then they could come at 16 pi squared f, which is 1 over lambda, then 1 loop, yes. But if you assume that this is not the case, then you can apply this general counting. Okay, to the first part, you can now write down all the operator classes of next to leading order. I've just sketched some examples here. So there's one class which includes the t parameter and only the t parameter. This is something that only has nominally two derivatives. So this we have written down at leading order. But like I said, we assumed that this is preserved as a symmetry at leading order. So when we include the spurion of custodial breaking here, then you also have to induce a weak coupling, and then the whole operator would have chiral dimension 4. Then we have the operators with really 4 derivatives that were also known from chiral perturbation theory. We have operators with 1 field strength tensor and 2 field strength tensors, all of them without fermions. And then we have 4 classes of operators that also involve fermions. So we have the vector currents coupled to the Z. We have scalar currents, tensor currents, and we also have the 4 fermion operators that's next to leading order terms. Okay, so much for part one. So this was the discussion of our assumptions and the effective field theory and the expansion parameter. Now I'd like to compare this expansion to the expansion with the linearly realized symmetry. So for that, I'd like to show you this graph. So every dot in here represents operators or classes of operators or something that you have in a physical amplitude. And then you can plot them according to the number of loops where this, call it operator, arises, and at which canonical dimension this operator arises. So the pure standard model terms, for example, would be in the bottom left corner. If we now think about the expansion that I was just showing you, you see that the expansion in the chiral case is taking as leading order the left column, so everything at two level, but not restricted to any canonical dimension. And then next to leading order, in that sense, would be an expansion column by column from left to right. So next to leading order, the one loop terms would go from here all the way to infinity and so on. So we would really sum up all the operators in here. So there would be a resummation in this parameter xi up to infinity. And this resummation is, of course, implied because we worked under the assumption that v is of the order of f, so xi is of order 1. So there is no way you can do a reasonable expansion in xi, so you have to resum all the powers. This is sketched in this graph. Now, if you compare this to the linear EFT, what you have there is you have a gap to the scale of new physics, and the leading order that you write down is renormalizable. So for the standard model case, you write down dimension 4 terms in terms of the real doublet field Higgs with the Goldstone and the physical Higgs. And then you can write down the Lagrangian as an expansion in canonical dimensions. So like I said, you start with the standard model at dimension 4. You have dimension 5 term that was classified by Weinberg in the 70s that is violating Lepton number. You have dimension 6 terms. For one generation, there are 59 conserved baryon Lepton number. They are fully classified quite recently, but discussed longer before that as well. And then in the last year, we had the addition of dimension 7 and dimension 8 terms. The numbers I give here are all for just one generation of fermions. So if you go to the physical case of 3 generations of fermions, these 59 here will become 2,500. And I think for the case of dimension 8, it's not even known yet how many operators you have if you go to higher than just one generation. Okay, if we have this picture and we look back in this graphical way that I just showed you, you see that this is an expansion that is going row by row. So we start from the bottom where we have the dimension 4 terms, including possible standard model loop corrections among them. And then next to leading order will be dimension 6 case in the standard model with the assumption of lepton and baryon number conservation. And then the corrections to that will be of dimension 8. So you really sum up row by row from top to bottom. And if you now compare the two expansions with just leading order Lagrangian and next to leading order Lagrangian, you see that in our case, we would discuss those operators here, and with next to leading order, those operators here. Whereas in this case, we discuss these operators here and then the correction of those. So we would single out different effects to being more important than in the other case. In that sense, these expansions are different. If you go to any order in EFT, then you just sum up all the dots, and then you have the same thing. Which means that you can if you start from a doublet structure with the doublet phi, and you write down invariant phi deca phi, this is basically just the VEF plus scalar H squared. If you expand that to any high power, you can reproduce any polynomial of H that you want. But this means you have to go to any canonical dimension because the doublet comes with a canonical dimension. But in that sense, you can reproduce a singlet structure with a doublet. But this would mean you reorganize your expansion from row by row to column by column. Okay, now let's assume something which is phenomenologically more motivated because we don't see any new scale and no effects of new physics yet. So we have to assume that this scale of symmetry breaking, the scale F, is somehow above the weak scale. And this means now we have a two parameter, and we have two small parameters that we can expand into. We have on one hand side the loop expansion of the chiral Lagrangian, and we have a further expansion in canonical dimensions in terms of xi v squared over f squared. If we apply this, you will get a consistent description of a strongly interacting like Higgs, that is sometimes called Silch, in abbreviation of this strongly interacting light Higgs. And there were some proposals of Lagrangians for strongly interacting light Higgs before, and we compared to those, and it turns out that the power counting that was given and discussed before is somehow ambiguous and depending on some certain classes of UV theories, whereas our model is not. So in some sense, we are extending what they were discussing before. And since everything is well-defined in terms of this double expansion, it is also very straightforward to just go beyond what is discussed as next to leading order now. Okay, how does this look like in terms of this graph? Well, depending on the size of xi, you will have an expansion that goes more or less diagonally in this plane. So if xi is of the order of the loop factor, then there would be the xi to the power of 1 and the one loop term here that are of the same importance. If we go to the case that is currently like the given limit from LHC, then xi is like 0.1. So we have to include terms of order xi squared to be actually of the size of the loop factor. So the whole thing would be more tilted. And then you also see how these different expansions that I discussed before are connected somehow, because somehow xi is gauging the way between completely nonlinear and completely linear expansion. If xi is really like 1, then the whole thing would be completely straight up, and we are back to the chiral expansion. If xi is really small, then this means that we put f to infinity, which is the decoupling limit. So we arrive at the standard model, its leading order, and then add corrections of dimension 6 and so on top of that. Okay, this was the comparison to the linear EFT. Now we apply our framework to the latest data of LHC, being my third part. And with that, we start again with writing down the full Lagrangian. So now I included the leading order terms and the next to leading order terms. And now we're seeing what are the actual observables that LHC experiments are seeing. Well, what they report is the production and the decay of single Higgs processes. And the production and decay happen either at tree level, so we have a tree level coupling between one single Higgs and the vector bosons W, Z, or to the third generation of fermions. And this means that from all the terms in the Lagrangian over here, we focus on the one that have just a single Higgs and the coupling to W and Z, which will be hidden here, and the coupling to single Higgs from this Yukawa-like term. But then there are also processes that are observed that are of one loop order. So the production in gluon fusion and also the decay to gamma-gamma. When we compare this in our theory, we see that we have some contributions from leading order loops that also include the vertices that I already discussed. And the whole size of this operator will be of 1 over 16 pi squared because this is a loop. And if you now include or look at the next two leading order terms, you see that those are of the same size because we constructed them to be of the size of one loop correction. So the local Higgs 2 gluon-gluon or gamma-gamma will be of the same size as those interactions. So for leading order analysis, we also have to include those operators coming from L and LO there. So
there is no a priori relation between Yukawa order 0 and Yukawa order 1.
No, it's not.
So you could in fact include
Yes, can also be done. Yeah. So if we do look at the restriction I just explained to you, you will arrive at this Lagrangian that we used for our fit. So we have the W and Z coupled to a single Higgs. Since we assumed custodial symmetry, they are described by one parameter. We have the coupling of the Higgs to the third generation fermions. And we have the two local contributions of Higgs to gamma gamma and Higgs to gluon gluon. And the three parameters in this approach, there are six of them. And the power counting tells us that the value is given by the standard model value of this coupling plus corrections of order xi. So the first terms that arise at leading order will be 1 plus corrections of order xi, and the last two will be 0 corrections of order xi, so the degree of order xi in general. And what was I about to say? Yes, now when you start seeing more decays or more production modes in experiments like Higgs to a pair of muons, Higgs decaying to Z gamma, then you can trivially just extend this term in the Lagrangian and you have one more free parameter for that. If you start seeing double Higgs production, you also have to include a couple more terms in the Lagrangian, but it's still somehow a managed level of free couplings that you have. With this description, you can look at the different processes and compare to what the experiments were reporting, and you find something that is called the kappa formalism. And the kappas of the experiment are given as the ratio of the decay width or the production cross-section normalized to the standard model. So they were reporting this for the different production and decay channels. And what we and the way they were defining it initially was to have somehow a handle if the Higgs particle is standard model-like or not. So the motivation was we fit it to the data, and if it turns out to be all kappas are equal to 1, then we know that we have a standard model. If they're not equal to 1, we have something else. But this was just a phenomenological tool. It was not understood as some effective field theory description that you could actually learn something from the kappas once you see that there's a deviation. But now we found, when you compare those kappas to our formulation, that they are actually really close. So you can justify the kappas within the nonlinear EFT. And to do that, you see that for the tree-level decays, the kappas are trivially the same. So we have the three couplings to the third generation and to the vectors, and you have the same for the kappas. When you go to the one loop level, like I explained before, in our case, we'd have the sum of the local guy and the two loop contributions, where in the way the kappas are defined would have just one term for all of these processes together. But still, the number of free parameters that you have on the left and on the right-hand side is the same. So if you do this transformation from variables from the kappas to the Cs, which just means that you have a different description of the loop-induced processes, then you can make all the kappa analysis already consistent with QFT, and you can directly interpret the results within an effective field theory, which means it's not just a phenomenological tool of saying standard model is right or wrong, but it actually gives a direction in which we can look at to interpret the data. Yeah, of course, also efforts to interpret and extend the kappas in terms of the dimension 6 Lagrangian. So let me just comment on the relation of the dimension 6 Lagrangian to the kappas. And as an example, take the decay of Higgs to Z gamma. When you go and you include the full set of dimension 6 operators and you do a leading order analysis, then it means you only have tree-level dimension 6 couplings. So you see you only have one free parameter here, which means it's not reproducing the kappas because the first two contributions are standard model-like. If we include dimension 6 terms within the loop, then we would also have modifications of the Higgs Yukawa, but there would on top of that also be contributions of the Z coupling to fermions that cannot be factorized in terms of the kappas that we discussed before, because this is we cannot factorize this coupling here into there. And on top of that, you see that there's a hierarchy between the expected size of those terms, because this would be coming at tree level and those would be coming at root level. So it would power counting in this case would mean that the first effect, the local guy, would be two orders of magnitude larger than the other effects. What people then started to do is to put further assumptions on the dimension 6 case, which one of them is you can assume that the UV theory is weakly coupled. And this would mean that the dimension 6 operators can be classified as being generated by loops or generated at tree level. If you do this, you would find that this first term indeed comes with an additional suppression, so all of them would be at the same order, but you still have the coupling of the Z to the fermions that cannot be factorized in terms of the kappas. You can now start making even further assumptions, saying lab put a lot of constraints on the Z to fermion coupling, so I can neglect this. Okay, you can do that, but the limits on the Z to top couplings are not really big from lab either, so neglecting this is still somehow not a really good approximation. But the whole motivation of this discussion in the dimensional six case is just you try to put assumptions in there that creates a hierarchy between observables in the Higgs sector and observables in the gauge fermion sector. And this whole hierarchy is already built in a nonlinear Lagrangian by the dynamics that we have. So we don't have to make further assumptions to actually arrive at this hierarchy when the dimension six case has to do this. So instead of starting from dimension six and making different ways and even more assumptions, you could also directly do the analysis in terms of the nonlinear Lagrangian, and you don't have to do these assumptions. Okay, this is somehow summarizing what I just said, where I have a timeline of the different phases of the LHC with the first one on the left and the future high luminosity phase on the right. And next to them, I just give the typical analysis that people were doing or that are discussed to be done right now. So for the first data that we had, people started to make consistency checks of the standard model. So there were some groups that are doing two parameter fits. You just rescale the Higgs to vector coupling with one parameter and the Higgs to fermion coupling, all of them in the same way with a second parameter. And this was the right thing to do because at round one we had really not much data, so the statistical uncertainties were very high. In order to learn something, you need to have only a few parameters. And now that we have gaining more and more data with better statistics, we can do even more complex analysis, like a full analysis of next to leading order EFT. Could be dimension six, could be the chiral Lagrangian, depending on whether we see some deviations or not and how these deviations look like. But the pros and cons of this approach are already explained. So the big advantage of this left side is that you only have a few parameters, so you will be able to constrain them somehow. But this was just not based on QFT. This was just an ad hoc scaling. So you don't really learn anything from that except from standard model is not working. And on the other hand, the full analysis in terms of effective field theory will be based on quantum field theory, so you will have the right interpretation directly. But if you have like 20 or 60 Wilson coefficients that you fit, you really need to have a good statistics. Otherwise, you can fit anything and won't learn much from that. And if you now plug in the description that I gave you before in terms of the six parameters in this picture, you will see that this is somehow combining the advantages of both sides. It has just a few parameters, so in our case it was six, but with like C gamma in addition could be seven, but still less than 20. But it also is based on effective field theory, so it would be really directly interpretable. And this is also, since it's in the middle now, it's corresponding to what we are doing right now, because we don't have so much statistics right now, so we need to have some kind of description that is capable of telling us now what we actually have. Yes. If you make this assumption, or if you don't make this assumption,
making a point of not making assumptions, then your set is still much larger than six. So you are somehow this MFB kind of approach is important somewhere, right? But
yes, there are definitely assumptions like that included.
Why one is equal or with some coefficient to capital one,
yeah.
Zero, right?
Yeah.
As a matrix.
But I mean, you also have this assumption somehow in dimension six case. Otherwise, you would also have the flavor changing currents there. Okay, then with this fit Lagrangian at hand, we were actually performing the fit in a Bayesian framework. So what we were interested in is the posterior probability density function, which is the probability of the parameters given the data that we have. This is given by Bayes' theorem as the prior multiplied with the likelihood, where the likelihood is the other conditional probability, meaning it's the probability of the data given the parameters. And what we were using is the following. As a prior, we used the information that we had from our power counting. Remember, I just said that our power counting tells us that the C coefficient should be standard model plus corrections of order xi. So what we put in here is a flat prior in the range of standard model plus an order of magnitude times xi. In some cases, we found out at the end that the fit is actually really constraining, so we were able to cut off a bit from the left and right to just enhance the size. So that's why the coupling of V has a bit narrower region, but we are always checking that the choice of priors is not really affecting the results of the fit. And from the side of the likelihood, we were using a code that was published in February, which is called Lilith. It had the experimental results coded into it and also the correlations as far as they're available on the experiments. So you just basically compute the thickness strength in terms of your Lagrangian. You give that number to the code, and the code will just tell you what the likelihood of this thickness strength is. And this is what we used for our fit. And as data input, we used the latest database of Lilith, which contains the combined preliminary results of Atlas and CMS of RAM 1. And as a result, we found the following. So we have the mean values of the six couplings. The way they are given here, they are marginalized over the five other couplings. So if you just look at the vector coupling, there is no assumption given on the five others if you just look at this one. So we are marginalizing over the ones that we are not shown. And the numbers here are also given in this plot on the right, where it's easier to see how it looks like. Well, it's the same data that everybody has from round one, so we still see standard model-like behavior.
C gamma gamma and CGG, there's a coefficient in front of the quantum.
Exactly. So the first four are from the leading order Lagrangian, where we expect them to be close to 1, and the last two are from the next leading order terms we expect them to be close to 0. And we see everything is consistent within 1 or maybe 2 sigma, so there are no surprises hiding here. We do see that the Higgs top coupling is a bit enhanced, which comes from the fact that the Higgs top associated production thickness strength reported by the experiment is a bit higher than the standard model value. But since you observe the gluon fusion at the rate of the standard model, the local gluon term is compensating for that. So this is somehow reflected in here. And you also, computed the correlation matrix of the six parameters, and you see that there are some terms that are higher correlated. For example, the gluon local guy with the top coupling, like I just said, there's some higher correlation here. But there's also a correlation between the Higgs to vector coupling and the Higgs to B quarks, which comes from the fact that you only observe the decay of Higgs to BB bar in the associated vector production, because in other cases you have too much background.
Mind me, if I put all the first four coefficients to 1 and C gamma gamma negative, this would to try to enhance the decay or suppress?
This would suppress the decay. Yeah. So since this coupling here is enhanced and this one's compensating it, this is
positive contribution, right? And the top.
Yeah. Yeah.
How much does it depend on your priors?
Not much. So if you look at this second thing, this is the range of priors that we looked at, and you have the codability interval of 68 and 95%. And you see if you cut the prior a little bit, you're not touching the 2 sigma, so it's not really doing anything.
Still, but still sticking a flat one, right? Another thing you could have done is you could have said that these GG and the photon at some dimension 6 operators, then there's a mass there, and you don't know what the mass is, so you could have had a flat prior of mass. But that wouldn't have been a flat prior for the coefficient. So that's a different functional form for the prior.
Yeah. Well, we only checked the flat prior and some like Gaussian-like prior centered at the standard model, which would single out the standard model to be more likely because you have more prior density, so to speak, for the standard model. But we aren't checking any other ways of assigning priors. Yeah, so these are four examples of two-dimensional plots. All the four parameters that are not plotted are marginalized over, so this is the remaining two-dimensional probability density, and you do see some of those correlations that I just told you, like the top and gluon guy, which is diagonal here, and also the correlation between the vector coupling and the B quark, which gives correlation. But like I said, there are no surprises. Their standard model is within 1 to sigma, so everything is still consistent, but the error is quite large. So if you go look at these errors here, you see the most constraining one is the one with the vector coupling, which is like 8%, 10%, and the others are bigger in this case. So we really need to run two data to see whether there is something hiding in there or not. Okay, this brings me to my summary. So I presented to you the electroweak chiral Lagrangian in the first part of the talk. Sorry?
How well so for that the previous one? So what will happen with those contours with round two and
well, I think the projection for round two is like 5% on the couplings, maybe a bit better in some cases. So we're going down a factor of 2, roughly. Okay, so in the first part, I presented to you the chiral Lagrangian, and I discussed the power counting in terms of chiral dimensions. In the second part, I showed you the relation to from the nonlinear EFT to the linear EFT, and I discussed the phenomenologically relevant case where we have a double expansion in both. And in the third part, I justified the phenomenological kappa framework in terms of the chiral Lagrangian, and I presented a fit to the latest LHC data using the nonlinear EFT. Thank you.
Can we jump in with questions? So I kind of lost the connection between the first half and the second half. So the first half, you kind of went through this exercise where you organized things in powers of C. You had your two small parameters. And for one limit of that was looking like a linearly realized standard model, and the other one was looking like probability. But then when you did your fits, which of those were you using? I wasn't quite sure.
Well, we assumed that psi is like 0.1. So we did the double expansion, but we assumed that it's looking more like the chiral way than like the dimensional way.
So if you've done that the other limit, so it was just linearly realized standard model with dimension 6 terms. How much does that change the accuracy with which you think you agree with the standard model?
Well, if you just if you fit dimension 6, it depends on how you do it. So if you go back to this case, if you just do like the leading order way of doing things, then you would have only the local guy. So you think the limit would decrease because you just have a 1-parameter fit or maybe 2-parameter fit. But this won't tell you much about this nature of the Higgs somehow, because you don't capture those effects in here. If you include the next to leading order, so these loop terms, then you will have many, many more operators. Because when you go from leading order to next to leading order, you really have a lot of new operators kicking in.
And does they come in with suppressed coefficients? Does that really make a difference to your fits?
I mean, we haven't done the fit in terms of the linear case, but since you have like 20 operators that are relevant for all observables right now, I think you won't get many more information out of them because it's just.
So the bottom line is that the linear one is a little bit more informative because it's just got one fewer parameter. So there's a fewer parameters.
Yeah, exactly. We were using a parameterization in terms of the leading order, which is just a few parameters, and that we will get more information out of that. And on top of that, you still have this hierarchy in our Lagrangian that you single out couplings to the Higgs to be more important than couplings of the gauge fermion sector, which are next to leading order in the chiral Lagrangian. When you go to dimension 6, you assume all those effects to be coming at the same level. So in the same time you fit anomalous Higgs couplings, you also fit anomalous gauge couplings. So you include all those effects from lab and everything else. And this is kind of enlarging your parameter space and everything. Of course, we can also include lab data in the chiral framework, but the leading order terms are not sensitive to them. So we have to go to next to leading order. And then we would have more terms than in the linear case at next to leading order. But this is well beyond the projected precision of LHC.
Any other questions? If not, then let's thank the